Calypso, but you may wonder what it has to do with cricket. The answer is that, so far as I know, it's the only recording of a calypso made by a West Indies test team. Certainly the only one by the historic side of 1950. The solo singer is Geoffrey Stollmeyer, the opening bat of that team and the manager of the present one. The pianist, Lance Pierre, the fast bowler. And that timpani, if we may call it that, is Everton Weeks rapping on the top of the piano with a spoon. And while I'm not trying to name the falsetto, the chorus is the rest of the team. I didn't dare begin this program with
cricket, lovely cricket. At last there I saw it. Cricket, lovely cricket. At last there I saw it.
Didn't dare because it's so much the best known calypso, in Britain at least. So light, so gay, so apt, so perfectly on cue, so gaily accepted that through sheer popularity and repetition, it's become over-familiar. But it, and cricket, represent in so many British minds all that's most obviously exhilarating in West Indian life that the two have become linked together. Calypso cricket, people say. And that means West Indian cricket. Useless to say that the calypso belongs to Trinidad, or, as someone whispered to me the other day, that the strength of modern West Indian cricket is Barbadian. For a whole generation in both England and Australia, the spirit of the West Indies is crystallized by calypso and cricket. But for many of us, West Indian cricket had become important long before then. The English teams that went there and were held to a drawn test series in 1929-30 and beaten in 1934-35 and again in 1947-48 had no doubt of the high quality of their cricket. But somehow, West Indian sides seemed less certain of themselves in England and Australia when they were firmly beaten in tests. Still, they made an immense impact in England in 1928. I was still at school at the time, but like everyone else in England, I was thrilled by Leary Constantine, now Sir Leary. He was a cricketer, it seemed, by nature, by birth and by upbringing.
All the boys in our family played cricket. My father first came to England with the West Indies team in 1900, and my uncle, on my mother's side, also played for the West Indies. So you see, if I was cricket on both sides, then I just couldn't help it. My father used to talk cricket to us far above the level of the average child. He'd tell us not only about movement, but about what was passing through the other fellow's mind. He believed cricket was a means of expressing character. Some people find cricket dull and uninteresting, but it shouldn't be. It's only a study. I remember my first cricket bat when I was 4 or 5. It wasn't a cricket bat in the sense that English boys know them. It was made from a branch cut from a cocoa tree. The ball we played with was a young orange or grapefruit, dried in the sun till the rind came off, and rolled round until it became flexible, and we could get 40 or 50 runs off it before we demanded a new ball.
My first impression of Constantine was an aboundingly spectacular fast bowler, tearing open the strong Hampshire batting at that time on a good wicket at Southampton. He became the most exciting figure of that English cricket season when, by his bowling and precariously mighty batting, he turned the course of the game against Middlesex and virtually won it single-handed. Last of all, he captured the imagination as the finest fieldsman there's ever been. He ran like the wind, meant to pick up at top speed as if he was made of rubber and springs, and he caught with an almost superhuman certainty. His catching, indeed, wasn't limited to cricket balls.
I used to get my head boxed when I dropped a catch. My father used to say it meant I'd been thinking about what I was going to have for dinner. It was just lack of concentration. We learned to catch so that we could throw open knives to each other without hurting our hands. And we used to practice with my mother's best plates and cups. Our kitchen was set a little way away from the rest of the house. There was a long flight of steps down, then a distance of about 5 yards. There were 7 of us in the family, and when we finished a meal, my brother would stand on the kitchen steps, and I'd stand in the dining room, and I'd throw in all the plates and crockery for washing up. I can't remember that we ever missed any. Only a few years ago, my brother came over to England to see some cricket, and we took him a tour of the main district in a shower. We stopped for a meal at a wayside cafe, and at the end of it, my brother and I offered to help wash up. I stood at the table, and my brother went to the kitchen door, and I started spinning all the teacups and over to him. The manageress nearly died of heart failure. I think the people who were on the shower trip with us still laugh at it sometimes.
Constantine somehow personified West Indian cricket in the English mind between the two wars. But there was respect, too, for all their fast bowlers, John, Francis, Griffith, and Martindale, and for the first master batsman, George Headley. Constantine was to remain many years in England, to become High Commissioner for Trinidad and Tobago, and to receive a knighthood. But in between their uncertainties in other countries during the 30s and their historic victory in England of 1950, West Indian cricketers changed in character, or technique, or temperament. Geoffrey Stolmeyer came to England as a young batsman in 1939, returned to open innings for the team of 1950, and after captaining West Indies at home, he was appointed manager of the 1966 party to England. How does he see the change?
Looking back at 1939, I was then a very young man and probably not able to appreciate all that was going on in cricket. I mean, I was just learning. But having come back after the war, right in 1950, and then seen our players, our current players, I would say that our team has now become a very professional one. I think that the approach is a far more calculated and professional one than it used to be. And we've been able to do this without losing that little verve that West Indies cricketers have, if you know what I mean. They're able to look attractive and yet play in a very professional manner. Our early teams, for instance, we had a few very outstanding players, great players. I would go back to the days of George Headley, who to me was, you know, was the one who really first showed this approach. But a lot of the rest of the team were carried by these players to some extent. No, this isn't so.
That used to be said that while the West Indies could beat England in the West Indies, they lost in England because they had some of an inferiority complex when they got home. Well, given that was true.
I don't believe this is true. I don't believe it's so much of an inferiority complex as a question of technique on English cricket. Now, this brings up the matter of playing in the league. A lot of our top players have been in league cricket, and I feel that this has done a great deal for their technique. They have learned how to play on English wickets, on the slow wickets up north, and they've adapted their styles to this. And if they get slow and turning, they can play on them. Before the war, we used to make very small scores on wickets which turned. The players have matured temperamentally also. They now think in terms of really big scores, and they don't chuck their wickets away in the 60s and 70s, as used to be the case very often.
George Headley's successors were the famous 3 Ws, Frank Worrall, Everton Weekes, and Clyde Waltick, Barbadians all. great batsman, by the standards of all cricket history. Geoffrey Stormeyer played with them at their greatest.
The three W's.
Three great players.
Different in style, all of them.
Worrell,
Frank Worrell, the most correct technically. And the one that you take your son to look at. Everton Wheat, well, he was legend you out of the game if he got the chance. And he was a real murderer, particularly on hard wickets. And he never let up. He always gave 100%. And he was always in there pitching. He's a great chap to catch in with Everton. Clyde, then, I think he was the one when he got into his stride, particularly when the Australians were out in the West Indies in 1955. He was the one that the bowlers didn't like to bowl to because he could hit you as hard off the back foot as he could off the front. And this really makes it rather difficult to know where to pitch the ball.
When John Goddard brought his 1950 side to England, reports and the opinions of the English players who'd met them in 1948 over there had already created respect for the three W's. And tradition said that the main attacking strength would lie in the fast bowling. But after England had won the first test on a lash heap at Old Trafford, it was the spinners, the two raw 20-year-old country lads, Alf Valentine from Jamaica, and Sonny Ramadan from Trinidad, who staggered the whole cricket world when at Lord's they first froze most of the England batting into immobility and then bowled the West Indies to the first overseas test win in their history. Ram and Val. Geoffrey Stormeyer was vice-captain of the side that discovered them, for even to the West Indians themselves, their performance was a revelation.
Oh, Ram and Val. I wish we had them here with this team, because undoubtedly they're the finest pair of spinners that West Indians have ever had. As you remember, in 1950, this was a bit of a gamble, these two lads. They'd had very little first-class experience, each of them about two or three games only. And then there was such an astounding success. Ramadan, particularly, I thought, was the troublemaker. He was the one that the batsmen really didn't like. I think they felt after a while they could cope with Val, although they didn't cope very well, but Ram upset them. And Val's bowling accuracy and then his sharp spin, well, they were a combination, weren't they? Valentine did the damage just as Ramadan did, but I think they did it as a pair. I think they made that 1950 team. Without them, we would be nothing.
That Lord's match was historic in more ways than one. It was the first time English cricket has heard a West Indian crowd in full cry. The rising tide of immigrants provided the first rail support any visiting side had ever had in England. And Lords and all the crowd there warmed to them. And when, at the end of the match, they swarmed across the pitch under the benign eyes of the police, it seemed as if that now hackneyed calypso sprang spontaneously out of their joy.
With those little pearls of mine,
after 1950, there came a period of eclipse, and it must be said of some temperamental uncertainty. Until Frank Worrell took the 1960-61 team to Australia. There's no doubt that Worrell himself made an immense contribution to that side. He was, I suppose, the finest captain the West Indies have ever had. At Brisbane, his side played out the greatest finish in the history of Test cricket. But it was historic in another way. It was the ultimate test of their temperament. And Frank Worrell knew it.
A bit worried, more interested in it than I do. I thought they might have cracked up on the stream. In the past, they always cracked up. On the field, I was very much concerned about holding together. And I was walking around, probably launched off the ground, saying, steady on, boys, don't let it worry you. You know, bad luck, boys, steady on, boys. And this seemed to have come through.
The West Indies lost that series by 2-1. But by the end, they'd achieved a remarkable triumph. They'd lifted public enthusiasm for cricket in Australia to heights it had never known since the days of Bradman. And when the tour ended, Australia paid its it's rather moving tribute. Frank Morrow recalls it.
Motorcade. And the morning passed so much more that the spontaneity of it, because the evening, actually, we'd accepted a function which was thrown by the Lord Mayor at the Town Hall. The Town Hall from our hotel is just a matter of 4 hours, which we'd intended walking. And then the evening before this reception, John Priestley of Jones, who was attached to the Melbourne Herald, came and asked me whether I'd mind us driving around the block. He said he was around the open cars, and then I said to him, of course, we see no objection to this. John, in the evening paper, just put a little note to the effect that the rest of his team would be driving around this block. And much to our surprise, and this article didn't have any sort of prominence in the newspaper, and much to our surprise, the following morning, 500,000 people were lying in the streets, and the traffic was at a standstill, and just easing our way through the crowds. The Australian people had converged on the vehicles, and they were saying things like, oh, well, good on you boys, you morally run chaps. And all the Australians, if any person said either of these things, you had about two people saying, come back soon. Well, tears came to my eyes every time you heard this, because then you realize that there's kind of a chance in the world of being back there so long as a player. And for this sort of thing to happen at such short notice, and the average sort of Melbourneite could only have read this thing on his label even the evening paper.
After their defeat in 1957 in England, the 1963 West Indians needed to prove themselves to themselves in conditions they don't take to easily. Frank Worrell.
Doing cricket 6 hours a day, 6 days a week, 6 months a year, and when you're not playing, you seem to be travelling. They're rushing around to catch trains and so forth. These are conditions which are foreign to our chaps, our fellows. Yeah. Tend to take the time of what most things. And it becomes a bit of a strain. Come July, I mean, no one else will see any suggestion of grass anyway.
A new harvest of talent had ripened, and at this point, we might digress briefly to wonder how the tiny island of Barbados, only 160 square miles, should produce such an amazing wealth of cricketers. Weeks, Worrell, Alcott, Silvers, Griffith, Hall, Hunt, Atkinson, Goddard, and already a fresh generation is treading on the heels of the established players. Now, I put this question to Roy Marshall, another of the brilliant Barbadian stroke makers, but now long settled in England and captain of Hampshire, perhaps sufficiently remote from his native island to offer an objective judgment.
Well, I'm sure many people have tried to answer this question, and I'm probably going to repeat quite a lot they've already said. Anyway, I don't think there's just one factor in this, but several. First of all, Barbados, and like some other islands such as Trinidad, was colonized only by the British and had no Spanish or Portuguese influence. This made cricket the number one sport without any other counter attractions, and consequently the keenness and interest in cricket built up over the years. Secondly, again, where Barbados is different from Trinidad and some of the other islands, the soil is the best in the world for making perfect wickets, not only on the main grounds, but on any strip of land on any part of the island. And lastly, the organization of cricket is such that the three leading schools play in the competition that includes all the leading club sides. Speaking personally, by the time I was 14 years old, I had batted in serious cricket against several test bowlers, and bowled against quite a few test batsmen. And to me, this practical experience was far better than all the coaching I could ever have received.
Once more, however, and as he'd planned and hoped, Frank Worrell secured another triumph. When he brought his 1963 team to England, the arrangements for future cricket tours had been made as far ahead as 1978. and the West Indies wouldn't have come to England again until 1971. 8 years away. Time for all that rich generation of talent to have faded. Such was the impact of that side that they barely left for home before the whole timetable of tours was changed to bring them back again in 1966. That meant that it was admitted on the highest levels of cricket administration that the game in the country where it was born needed a constant infusion of West Indian spirit if it was to remain truly healthy. The ordinary English cricket follower may admire the West Indians and especially those of 1963 for many talents and joys, but for nothing more than the brilliance and the effect which has brought them back to be enjoyed here again this season, and soon and often again.
No, by Dante
what is it for?
Well, in the song, Willie's morning, the guinea rum, I'm hearing a siren. In the song, Willie's morning, the guinea rum, I'm hearing a siren.
Look, a woman bawled out from over. Look, the whole of just been on fire. So in tune with the New Year's spirit, everybody jumped and we need a herd and chirping.
Look at the burning down.